KSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Hello, this is Rabble Radio, recorded on Friday, July 17th, 2026. I'm your host, Nick Seabrook. Rabble.ca shares the news of the day through a progressive lens. If you're curious about what's happening in Canadian politics, labor, the environment, and beyond, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us. Thanks for tuning in. This week's re-released episode takes us back to April 2007. In our 39th episode of Rabble Radio, New York-based writer Patty Johnson takes listeners into the art world of New York and in Canada. And Wayne McPhail and Chad Oberg talk about Second Life. From 2007, here is that episode. Take a listen.
Now, all you listeners, close your eyes for a moment and imagine you're a small but well-respected art dealer in New York. Your promotions get European dealers interested in your artists. Then they promote your artists right back to New York. But you, although you're based in that city, get passed over by the important juries. Now, what is an art dealer to do? Well, it might just be that the best thing to do is fly to England and speak your mind to those very selection committees. The art world is one heck of a competitive market. And Patty Johnson has the story.
I will make you understand.
Canada, a New York gallery founded by Canadian artist Phil Brower, went to unusual lengths this year to get accepted into the prestigious Armory Art Fair. My name is Patty Johnson, and the following documents a recent conversation I had with Phil in his office. Our talk begins with the new struggles that face emerging galleries with the growing importance of art fairs and leads into his unique methods of persuasion when it comes to getting his gallery into these events. We also discuss the aesthetics of art fair hanging and exhibition design and the possible, even probable, existence of Canadian art collectors.
It seems like it's really difficult for a gallery to survive now without doing an art fair.
You hear that line, and I guess it's sort of true. I mean, we sort of did. I mean, we survived a long time before an art fair, but we didn't really survive. We didn't thrive. You know,
well,
it
right.
helped.
I mean,
you know, it does. I guess it sort of helps. It exposes you to people who otherwise wouldn't come down, certainly to Chinatown, by art. So you sort of. We will in 1 week at the Armory get, you know, more exposure than we'll get in 6 years of being down here. You know?
Right. I mean, do you see like art fairs as part of your advertising or part of your programming?
That's a good question. I mean, I think you strive to make it something valid. And I mean, it's funny. Sometimes the dealers try to make these the art fair booth into a statement, installation. And I think sometimes it's actually pretty successful. I've had pretty good times at art fairs looking at some pretty good, decent installation. I sort of like when that occurs. And I also understand them also as strict trade fair group show, here's the leftovers from my showing year, you know, so admire that. So I really sort of like, I like both, you know, where it's like kind of this cool installation, you know, meta show, and sometimes the work is like site specific even, and it's an installation about the art market or something, and it's kind of okay, you know, or it's my installation about the art market, and it's a hodgepodge, Cracker Barrel hanging, come and get it, because I'm just at a stupid art fair anyway, and mothers, you know, so and then that was kind of it's like I wasn't going to do like a hot shot okay, you're on, do your solo show at Nada. It was like, I don't know, it was like a little bit of everything that we do, you know?
Right.
And that is helpful because I can, you know, with a wide group show, introduce a bunch of stuff to people who kind of want to see something. You know, it's like more democratic of me to kind of cover every artist and, you know, give them the opportunity to make some dough and have their work seen.
While two of the seven members on the committee deciding which galleries get into the Armory show in New York deal in Manhattan, the rest are located in England. Since all of them were participating in a fair called Frieze in London during the fall of 2006, it was for this occasion that Phil and his partner Sarah Brahman, who you incidentally often hear in the background of this interview, bought him Target pants and a plane ticket to England.
Well, did you go over to London specifically to badger people? Or
yes.
Really?
Yeah.
Scrounge together money to put him on a plane.
I don't know if they bought me a suit. Yeah, well, got me Target pants, and I got on the airplane because it was at this critical moment. We'd already lost this bum artist, you know, because we didn't make it into the Armory Fair.
Right.
So we were like, you know, and it was like either we're going to do this and wrestle our way into this thing. Or we're going to have to be, or we will likely be ignored by them because they don't need to care. I don't know. I mean, maybe some galleries are lucky enough to get pianists, you know, like, oh, please come, you know, you're so important to the scene that we need to have you. I mean,
I've never worked at one of those galleries. I kind of wish I had. That'd be interesting.
I think they needed their cage rattled. And this is the problem I think I have, is that I think the committee's likely too small and probably too old, you know, to be able to really discriminate and know what the hell's going on downtown. They're very busy people.
Yeah.
You know? They're doing their own damn shows. They've got their neighborhood in Chelsea. I don't think it's the mandate, really, to kind of go into the outback and find the dealers that are, or the galleries that are kind of doing the heavy work.
Unfortunately, it's not really necessary for them to do that.
No.
You know? So you kind of have to make it necessary.
You do.
You know?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, it's a weird thing because these art fairs have an impact that, you know, your name on that list and your position in that fair, be it in the coach or whatever, you know, has some bearing on why someone might choose to take your artist to a museum show or take show them in, or buy them or whatever. Likely it helps. And I don't know how that should be decided on, whether these kind of five Europeans and two New Yorkers should have all that authority, because I do think it is, you know, it does advertise, it does change the currency and the demand for likely to work here. So.
Often to the detriment of these smaller galleries struggling to get accepted into the fairs, the side of the story that sees the most coverage is how long these events will shape the art market. Only 7 or 8 years ago, galleries sold most of their inventory from their exhibition spaces, whereas now, dealers who don't show at these fairs suffer significantly from lack of exposure and poor sales.
I mean, this is the bigger story, you know, really. It's like, it's because it's a musical chairs thing, and it's, you know, it's getting bigger or smaller. It's like, how long does the party get bigger, you know?
Well, yeah.
Like, this is the other question that people are all asking, you know? It's like, well, you know, is the bubble going to burst and all this crap? And it's, and you know, it's like, I don't even... No, I don't. I'm not. I've never really been aware of a bubble. I mean, I've just been doing this thing, you know. But apparently, there's a lot of galleries and a lot of art being kind of, you know, sold on the market. And I guess there's the you know, the community to support that.
Yeah, you know, I mean,
you know, we've broke even or done well at all these things somehow. Still sort of shocks me.
Well, I mean, that's a real change.
But that's because I'm Canadian.
I know about that. Just,
you know, selling art is still like a slap in the face. You know, I still can't believe it. You know?
I know. I mean, it's hardwired into us.
Yeah, you know, it's the last thing you buy. I mean, nobody buys art, right? I mean, no, I think I'm probably all wrong, but you know, because we do have sell some work to Canadian collectors.
Oh, yeah?
Mm-hmm. I think so, yeah.
That's crazy. I knew there were like three of them, you know.
Okay, this is now we're going to get in trouble. Yeah, I don't know where the bubble is, but it's not in Canada.
Yeah, they'll do fine.
When the art bubble bursts, yeah, Canadians won't feel it, you know? Except the Canadians in New York.
Yeah, I know, we'll definitely
feel it. Yeah, me and you.
And my lack of knowledge about the Canadian art market closes off my interview for Rabble Radio with Phil Grauer of Canada Gallery. Thanks for listening, and as always, stay tuned, or in our case, subscribed.
That was writer and artist Patty Johnson talking to Phil Grauer at the Canada Gallery in New York, New York. You can check out the full interview on Patty's blog, artfagcity.blogspot.com. Patty will also be reporting for Rabble Radio from the Creative Commons Conference in Croatia this summer.
A few weeks ago, I sat down with Chad Oberg. Chad is a design consultant and architect and a blogger on the subject of space and design. As you may know, Rabble.ca is making a foray into the virtual world known as Second Life. So, as a part of my podcast, Who's on Second, I took a half hour to talk to Chad about his view of Second Life and architecture. Here's part of our conversation.
The interesting thing to me always centers around the experience of space, the kind of effectual experiential component of that, what it feels like to be in a giant grand sort of concert hall versus being in a tiny claustrophobic cave. I mean, these all have kind of emotive experiential effects upon people, and I've always sort of maintained or even observed in some senses that it doesn't really matter what the stuff is that makes up that space in terms of its materials. You can experience a space and have it impart some kind of emotional effect upon you, regardless of whether it's built out of bricks or glass or polygons. And it seemed to me that architecture, as it facilitates functions in the real world, you know, whether it's an office space or a store or a church or what have you, is also facilitating functions in the game space. You know, even though the functions were predominantly running around with a gun and trying to blow up everything in sight. When Second Life came along, it kind of blew the door wide open and said, okay, we're no longer focused on missions and quests and leveling up and blowing things up. I mean, you can do all those things if you want to, but it just became much more open-ended, and the goals became much more personal, and that ability for space to kind of envelop and frame a bunch of different functions that happen in Second Life, like gathering, like commerce, like worship, the role of the architect became, I think, much more acute in being able to facilitate those functions or throw up barriers to facilitating those functions.
Well, I want to go back to a few things that you raised. One of the things early on you were talking about reminded me back in a really early podcast, I was talking with Delia Lake of the Center for Water Studies, and she was talking about the notion of people who were ill or couldn't move their limbs, watching a healer move and go through a sequence of motions and actually get some therapy from the act of watching those people move. And she related that to possibly having the same kind of therapeutic effect by watching an avatar move in a three-dimensional space. And that resonated with me when you were just talking now, because it sounds like you're sort of saying the same thing, except in regard to space, that moving in a virtual space can have the same kind of emotional impact as moving in a real space.
Absolutely. I mean, really, once we get past the architecture as a shelter and protection from the elements, I think we've all kind of accomplished that, you know, and in Second Life it's not necessary, and here in the real world we sort of take it for granted. But then, moreover, I mean, it just becomes a question of context and a question of meaning. And I keep coming back to the example of a church because we see a church. It's infused with all this kind of symbolism, significance. It's not only the experience of the space, but it's also a literal read of the elements in a classical tradition and those kinds of things. But what would it be like to have a church service out in the middle of a meadow or in the middle of a Costco store? You know, how does the experience of worship, which is, you know, it's theatric, it's cerebral, and as such, I mean, it seems to be one of those fluid things that transcend the physical to a certain extent, and what it taps into is it kind of taps into the notions of the brain and how the brain perceives spaces. You know, if we're on a tall precipice in Second Life and we look down, even though there's no gravity, I mean, there's still some kind of emotional effect that has upon you for being up that high in the air. Same thing when you're standing too close to another avatar. You feel that notion of interpersonal distance, and you actually feel uncomfortable when you're standing too close to them because there's some kind of connection back to your how your physiological experience of space is going to manifest itself.
If you want to hear the rest of that interview, head for Who's on Second at rabble.ca/RPN/WOS.
And you can also check it out for yourself by joining in on a Rabble event in Second Life. On April 10th, we're hosting a talk with the author of Wickonomics, Don Tapscott. It's taking place at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, which is 6 p.m. Second Life time. And in case you're wondering, Second Life time is the same as the time in Vancouver, B.C. Whew! But no matter where you may be or what time it is, please take a few minutes to join us at the Rabble Treehouse on Better World Island. All the cool avatars will be there.
Kathy and Judy are watching what they eat. It's because they've watched Fast Food Nation, a film that purports to make you feel yucky about most of the things you put in your body. Here's their review.
Hey, Kathy, happy birthday.
Ooh, shucks. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, who wants to go first?
You go first because it's your birthday.
Well, thank you very much. Okay, well, the one that I picked was Richard Linklater's new film, Fast Food Nation. I thought this was a really good movie. I thought it was going to be a documentary for some reason.
Yeah, I did too.
I don't know. Why do we think that? Is that how
it was
pitched?
Well, because it came out at the same time as Super Size Me, and I got them mixed up.
Ah, I bet I did too. Yeah, I bet a lot of other people did. Yeah. Well, anyway, it's kind of an unusual movie, and it's about what happens when this VP of marketing for a company called Mickey's, which is a fast food chain, they discover that there is poo in one of their patties. So, you know, the CEO goes, we can't have this. So he sends Greg Kinnear, who plays the VP, down to Colorado to take a look and see what's actually happening. And the thing that I couldn't believe, because I live out on a farm, is they had thousands of head of cattle crammed into these little pens. Yeah. And then they'd send them off to this Uniglobe meatpacking plant where, oh, my God, you know, we don't want to let people in on what happens. But I will tell you one thing. After seeing the killing floor sequence at the very end of this movie, I don't think I will ever eat fast food ever again. It's that strong.
Well, I used to live near a meatpacking plant, so it's a long time since I ate fast food because of the stench.
So the thing that's kind of interesting is you watch this VP of marketing sort of gradually have the scales lifted from his eyes of what's happening. And in particular, there's a time when he goes to see an old-time rancher there who's been sort of almost forced into penury because of this meatpacking plant. And he talks to him about what's going on.
Mr. Henderson here would like to know if the meat over there is clean. He wants to know how cow manure could ever possibly wind up in his hamburger.
Well, there's lots of ways. My brother used to work at the gut table, and, you know, they have to pull out the intestines and the stomachs. And they just don't have enough time to do it right. The line is moving too fast. So when they're pulling the guts out and they make a mistake, all the poop and stuff just pours out all over the meat.
Okay. All right. But really, how often does that happen?
Every day.
And that's just one of the storylines is the VP. And then another storyline is illegal Mexican immigrants who are coming into the country and then going to work for this Uniglobe. And they're becoming hooked on drugs. They're, you know, they have to have sex with the Mexican boss. It's horrible the way that they're treated and what they're buying into just to be part of America.
Yeah.
So I thought it was very interesting. There were some things that I thought weren't as good. I thought the plots were kind of weird and how they weaved in and out.
Yeah, I thought it was a good movie. I was quite surprised by it. I, too, thought it was going to be a documentary. I think Fast Food Nation, the book, might be like a report on fast food. I don't think it's a novel somehow, but maybe it is. I don't know. But I thought it was good, yeah. I thought it was politically really good. And the thing that I thought was interesting was how the Greg Kinnear character gets corrupted. I mean, first he's... Yeah. First he's naive, then he learns the truth, and then he figures if he wants to stay in the job he's in, he's got to cover up the truth. So I thought that was a very good part of it, was how corruption works. You know? And, yeah, I mean, it's not an easy film to watch. Not just, you know, the part, the end, which is disgusting, but also just the whole storyline with how the illegal Mexican immigrants are treated. It was pretty hard to watch some of it. So I thought it was a good movie. I really would recommend it.
And there's all sorts of stars.
Rare. Yeah, all kinds of stars in it.
And who's your favorite star that's in the movie, Judy?
I love Kris Kristofferson.
Yeah, he was great.
And Bruce Willis. Yeah. It's my secret. My secret that I like Bruce Willis, because he's so counter all any type that you think I like, but I like Bruce Willis. I think it was a good movie. Yeah. And then the movie that I chose, which was fabulous. Very different than that, but fabulous.
Fantastic.
Fabulous movie.
That was Rabble.ca's Real Women. If you want to hear just what film it was that Judy's crowing about, head over to the Real Women podcast. It's rabble.ca/RPN/REE.
Was a clip from a Rabble Radio episode from 2007. To listen to the full original program, visit the link in the show notes of this episode. And now, this is our In Case You Missed It segment, where we review the top stories from this week on Rabble.ca. This week's In Case You Missed It is presented by Rabble's Piper Caniff. Let's jump right in. Take it away, Piper.
Starting this week with national news, Prime Minister Mark Carney has officially adopted the all-too-familiar claim that privatization will lead to lower costs and lower rates for the average citizen, despite records suggesting otherwise. The ongoing economic and climate crises have more ties to privatization propaganda than one might think. Similar to Ontario Premier Doug Ford's Bill 5, Carney's Bill C-5 gives his government the power to ignore environmental assessments and labor legislation concerning infrastructure projects. Propaganda like public-private partnerships, or P3s, are being promoted as something that average Canadians can invest in, despite the direct harm it causes those same people. The privatization of long-term care homes, Highway 407, and Hydro One have caused Ontarians to push back against the privatization of any more public assets, especially post-pandemic. New York State, Australia, and 9 countries in Europe have introduced public green power companies. As the climate crisis only worsens, green power and updated electrical infrastructure are only becoming more crucial. Next, in technology and labor news, Prime Minister Mark Carney and AI Minister Evan Solomon's AI for All strategy is being criticized for its harmful environmental impact and destruction of the job market. The strategy, which includes $2 billion in federal spending on artificial intelligence, prioritizes what Carney and Solomon deem as innovative and efficient, while sacrificing human labor and contributing to the ongoing climate crisis. In response to Carney's choice to follow Elon Musk's failed Department of Government Efficiency endeavor, Public Service Alliance of Canada head Sharon D'Souza said people can expect longer wait times for passports, EI, and healthcare benefits, more unanswered calls at Canada Revenue Agency, reduced public health and food safety efforts, and a government that isn't there for ordinary people when they need it most, end quote. According to recent studies, 55% of companies like Meta, who recently fired 8,000 employees in favor of AI, will come to regret their decision. The CEO of Swedish platform Klarna has already lived that reality, admitting that his decision to stop hiring humans led to poor customer service and plummeting satisfaction levels. Those who live near AI data centers have reported experiencing decreased air quality, dangerous temperature spikes, and a noticeable amount of pollution in their local drinking water. Other health concerns like migraines, insomnia, asthma, and declining mental health due to persistent noise pollution have also been raised. Canada's AI industry continues to have no meaningful regulation despite billions of dollars that have been allocated to its infrastructure, job loss it causes, and its catastrophic environmental impact. Also in technology news, a new AI data center by Meta Platforms Incorporated is set to be built in Edmonton, Alberta. Alberta Premier Danielle Smith's government continues to promote Alberta as an international hub for new AI data centers. The proposed $13 billion project will become Canada's biggest AI data center and one of the largest in the world if completed. This announcement followed a previous announcement on July 4th that Greenlight Electricity Center, a natural gas-powered electricity plant, would be built in Alberta's Sturgeon County. Greenlight will provide power for Meta. According to a recent report cited by journalist Andrew Nikiforuk in The Tea, the Alberta government's objective of building 14 AI data centers over the next two decades would occupy roughly 5,000 hectares, consume roughly 150 million megawatt hours of electricity, use 7 billion liters of water per year, and release 68 million tons of carbon dioxide. Despite the Alberta government's claims that the project will create thousands of construction jobs and hundreds of operational jobs, its environmental risks are evident. Next, in a column on Rabble, journalist and best-selling author Linda McQuaig reminds us that there was once a time in which the U.S. had tax justice. In 2026, implementing a necessary wealth tax on billionaires may seem impossible, but in the decades following the Gilded Age, people ranging from farmers to academics applied political pressure to a government that seemed content on leaving the ultra-wealthy untouched by the tax system. The combined political power of numerous groups of reformers led to the development of the U.S. income tax in 1913 and a Canadian income tax in 1917. University of California economists Emmanuel Saez and Gabriel Zuckman said in the 1930s, U.S. policymakers invented, and then for almost half a century applied, top marginal income tax rates of 90% on the highest income earners. Corporate profits were taxed at 50%, large estates at close to 80%. End quote. That high tax revenue would help lift the U.S. out of the Great Depression and finance roads, bridges, hospitals, and schools. A bubbling backlash against the modern elite, as evident by the election of New York Mayor Zoran Mamdani, who is committed to taxing the rich, has the possibility to inspire the inclusion of wealth tax as part of the U.S. Democratic Party's 2028 platform. Next, in Rabble's Book Lounge this week, Ron Verza reviews economic historian Trevor Jackson's The Insatiable Machine, How Capitalism Conquered the World. In The Insatiable Machine, Jackson analyzes the endless evils of the capitalist economic system, from its global ruin and environmental damage to its exploitation and contribution to overall human suffering. The five-chapter book outlines how capitalism has developed throughout different historical periods. While Jackson concludes that the world's current population of 8 billion people is better off than when it was only 1 billion, we continue to be ravaged by capitalism's many components. Money, monetization, marketization, violence, and environmental destruction, to name a few. As always, you can read the full versions of all the stories talked about today on Rabble.ca.
And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks so much for listening. To help support our show further, consider subscribing to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. You can also choose to subscribe to us over on Patreon for special bonus content of Rabble Radio. If you're already subscribed, consider making a donation to Rabble.ca at rabble.ca/donate. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on Rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nuremberg for supplying the music to this episode. I'm Nick Seabrook, and we'll talk to you next time. Thank you.
some party. Thank